From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made late last month when a local group issued a proclamation. The Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group declared racism a public health crisis and doubled down on their efforts to garner community attention and activism to the issue. Research shows racial health disparities are prevalent and growing. The coronavirus pandemic has exposed and exacerbated those disparities, with African Americans in Monroe County dying of COVID-19 at almost triple the rate of white people. That data follows the national trend of racial and ethnic minorities overrepresented in coronavirus data. Leaders in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, and Franklin County, Ohio, have issued proclamations similar to the declaration made by the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group. And the goal, those leaders say, is to call broad public attention to the issue and begin to work on large-scale solutions. This hour, we discuss the data, the root causes of the health disparities, and the actions that need to be taken to eliminate them. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Melanie Funches is a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and Director of Community Engagement at the Mental Health Association. Melanie, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Evan. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Jerome Underwood is with us, member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group, president and CEO of Action for a Better Community, and co-chair of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. Jerome, welcome back to the program.
And good afternoon to be with you. Good afternoon, Evan. Nice to be with you again.
Well, it's great to be with you on the phone. Someday soon we'll see each other in person. Jackie Dozier is with us. She's a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group as well. Jackie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
And Michael Campbell, member of the group and independent consultant and co-owner of North Star Rites of Passage, LLC. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Evan. Good to be here.
I want to make sure we understand exactly the mission of the group, and I will start with Melanie here. Tell us more about the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group, its founding and mission.
Okay, the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group was a group we were founded in 2015, and in short, we are a group that of concerned citizens that came together to center black voices and to center the issues of the black community in Rochester and elevate those and elevate the issues that are pertinent to us. So we've centered those issues in three, initially we centered those issues in three pillars. Education, health and wellness, and economic development. And we have been working in those areas over the years, and we seek to just elevate the issues in the larger context to say these are specifically things that affect black people in our community, and we believe that we should be centered in finding solutions to things, because too often in this community, people want to do to and for our community without talking to being with our community.
And Melanie, you know, there's obviously heightened national conversation about a wide range of issues surrounding race and Black Lives Matter. So much of that has come from the killing of George Floyd on May 25th. The group, the Black Agenda Group, issued this declaration a week before George Floyd was killed. And so this is not just flowing out of that. This is work that's been going on for quite a long time. But is this a moment where finally it happens, where finally there is the kind of public engagement that might be so, you know, often after a crisis or during a crisis, there's a spike in attention. And then, you know, people, especially people of privilege, sort of move on with their lives. Is this the moment of sustained attention and action, you think?
Well, what I do know is this is the moment that we are going to keep working, because we've been working, and tons of other people have been working. Our parents worked, our siblings worked, our grandparents worked toward this time, because I've been hearing, there's this persistent narrative that this is a time when everyone just woke up. That we have, the black community has been saying this message. This is a moment 401 years in coming. And so we are just now in a point where we are pushing this through. So I could say what I'm going to say, you know, this may be the moment, but this is one of many moments where we are going to push through until we win.
And so, Melanie, I'll start with you. I want to ask all four of you.
And wait. I want you to defer to my partners.
Absolutely. We're going to bring in everybody. In fact, why don't we do this here? The notion of racism as a social determinant of health is vital in understanding here. That's at the root of what we're talking about this hour, and that's at the root of the mission of what the Black Agenda Group is working on right now, helping the public see it in its totality. Racism as a social determinant of health. And I will ask all of you about this. I'll start with Jackie. Jackie, in the last couple of weeks, epidemiologists have taken some heat from critics who say, well, you can't tell people during a pandemic that you've got to physically distance and you got to be careful, but then also come out and support the protest movement. And epidemiologists have, by and large, come out and said, we recognize the risk. We don't want to see infection spread. But this is also a moment to demonstrate to the public once and for all that racism is a public health crisis. How do you see and how do you connect racism as a social determinant of health, Jackie? Do we have Jackie? Are you on mute, Jackie? Did we lose you?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yeah,
go
ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So social determinants of health, includes things like availability for resources, things that people need on a daily basis, safe housing, public safety, transportation options, quality of education and job training, the social norms. And attitudes which comes along with discrimination and racism and some distrust of the government.
Let me ask Jerome Underwood to elaborate on that. Go ahead, Jerome.
Thanks, Evan. And, a couple things we can say about this Black Agenda Group. We have a diverse group of folks, so you're going to hear different things that are charting up the same street on us. And for me, with respect to what has happened in the country in the past 2 weeks, we've been saying this, too much of the focus has been on the response as opposed to the antecedents that led to the protests. And part of those, some of those antecedents are social determinants of health with respect to, just to elaborate on what Jackie was saying, because if you don't have access to a safe neighborhood, if you don't have access to high-quality education, if you don't have access to fresh and affordable food, if you don't have access to high-quality and affordable care, if you don't have access to employment, those things are going to that's going to make you sick, like physically sick. So, and we know embedded in not having those things is deeply seated racism. So, there's a, as we said, preponderance of evidence why these things matter. And the pandemic was just brought out the spotlight once again, because none of these things are new. They're deeply embedded and some would say protected, not only in Monroe County, but this entire country. So you see the response is nationwide and international. So there's no debate that, what I said just now. It's the question is, what are we going to do? Because none of us want to go back to normal. Normal is a problem.
Mm-hmm. Michael Campbell.
Evan, the social determinants of health that impacts the Black and brown communities, it's devastating, because those communities have the highest infant mortality rate and the lowest life expectancy rate. As a matter of fact, the infant mortality rate in the Black community is between 3 and 4 times that of what it is in the white community. This statement that racism is a public health crisis. Now, there is no epidemiological definition of crisis, but the health impact of racism clearly rises to that definition when you consider that Black and brown people are forced to live in spaces that those determinants have a greater impact on. The availability of resources to meet daily needs, safe housing, local food markets, healthy food markets, access to educational, economic, and job opportunities. All of these things, all in those categories, Black and brown people are at the bottom of each and every one of those categories. And that's the reason that this COVID-19 epidemic is having so much of a greater impact in Black and brown communities.
Let me also ask Melanie Funch just to kind of weigh in on an understanding a social determinant here. Racism as a determinant of health, Melanie.
Oh, okay. So to start this, let's talk about what the social determinants of health are generally. So social determinants of health are the factors around living that determine your health outcomes. So things like food security. Do you have access to healthy food? Do you have a supermarket near your house where you have good access to healthy food? Stable income, job security, environmental quality. Do you have good clean air and good the groundwater near where you live clean? You know, neighborhood conditions. Do you live in a neighborhood with good, safe housing without lead? You know, things like that. Affordable quality health care. Do you have access to good, high quality, affordable health care where they use top of the line, first line health care things? Do you have education opportunities? Do you have fully funded schools? Do you have top trained teachers who know how to teach and teach in ways that are culturally congruent? Do you have, you know, do you have housing? Are you housing stable? Are you able to have secure housing month to month, day to day, week to week, year to year? For communities of color, for people generally, do you have discrimination or minority stressors? All of these things are the social determinants of health, because depending on what happens in these areas, it depends on how your health outcomes are. So how racism impacts each of these things is because of, let's say, housing, because it fits to all of them. Housing, because of redlining in our community, we have hypersegregation. And because we have hypersegregation, it is in turn caused a lessening of our tax base, which means that we have lesser funding for our schools. And because of the hypersegregation and the redlining, the redlining made it so people will not invest in certain areas. So because there's no investment, there's no businesses. With no businesses, there's no stores, i.e. no supermarkets. So many people who live in these hyper-segregated redlined areas live in also food deserts. And because of the redlining and the generational poverty, the neighborhood conditions are less than optimal. And so all these things tie in to one another. As you can see, these issues compound upon one another. And that's why racism is a public health crisis. And if you look at data, there's a great set of data compiled by Common Ground Health that talks about how there are 17 years of potential life loss for African-Americans based upon these social determinants and the health disparities that we experience. And also there's another study that looks at Black women that, you know, we talk about, you take a Black woman and a white woman at the same age, because when you control for all other things, our organs, we are internally, Black women are 7 years older than their white counterparts. When you control for all things, it's because of weathering the effects of racism. This is why we say racism is a public health crisis.
And I'm going to go over some more of the data here. Melanie was just talking about some of it. There's a number of reports that will inform the understanding of this. One of them is a report released late last year from Common Ground Health titled Overloaded. And from that report, we learned, as we've been talking about, here are some of the numbers. First of all, more years of life are lost to health inequity than all forms of cancer combined. Poverty takes an average of 8 years of life off the life expectancy of people in high poverty neighborhoods compared to those with lower rates of poverty. Neighborhoods can essentially trap people in poverty and harm health because many lack grocery stores, dependable bus service and transportation. People don't have money or time to afford quality medical care, and mental health suffers as a result, which we know mental health care is health care. And compared to residents with household incomes over $75,000, those with incomes under $20,000 are 105% more likely to lose their teeth, 154% more likely to have diabetes, 224% more likely to be diagnosed with depression. Finally, African-American infants in Monroe County die at 3 to 4 times the rate of white babies. That's a statistic that has not changed in many years, but if there is a trend at all, it is still trending in the wrong direction. I'm going to start with you, Jerome. You talked about toxic stress, but I'm looking at some of these going, I mean, some of this is historical, and it's not hard to understand. I don't fully understand the rate of African-American infant death compared to white death. I mean, it's remarkable, the disparities in almost every category. Do you feel like we understand it as well as we need to?
No. You know why I say no, an emphatic no? Because we haven't done anything to reverse the trend. Let me give another example. As you said, there's a preponderance of evidence that we, the collective we, need to get really, really serious and get the intestinal fortitude to change. The pandemic, which is our most recent crisis. Now, all the data we're talking about is not new. So with respect to the pandemic, and people knew already where the high-risk areas would be, you know, subsidized housing, people living close to each other, people with quote-unquote pre-existing conditions such as hypertension or lung disease, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we know where those people were. However, Evan, the collective we, it took almost 7 weeks before testing for the virus was set up at Jordan Health and or Trillia. In other words, in those very same neighborhoods that we knew would have high incidence of infection, right? Why did it take us so long and literally cause people to die as a result of it? You know, so again, the will, the will to change and to allocate the resources where they need to be has been fleeting. And we're hoping that all those people who had to die are not dying in vain. And it's up to us to stand in the gap for everybody else, because the next pandemic and the next whatever is coming. And this is a point where one of the first questions you asked, Melanie, you know, is this the proverbial tipping point? Is this the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back? Well, we thought that was Trayvon. We thought that was Eric Garner. You know, so we're not convinced of that. And that's why we're being much more aggressive right now. And thank you for the opportunity, because, you know, people who have the privilege and power to change these things, they are who we're talking to. Because the young people that we talk to, you know, and they're saying, you guys keep talking, nothing is happening. And Melanie, I got to say it, you know, and I'll say it here, that African proverb that says, if a child is not embraced by his village, he will burn it in order to feel its warmth. Now, pay attention mostly to the first part of that, not the second part. If the child is not embraced by his or her village. So let's do that. Let's embrace the child. And what that means is providing all the things that we just talked about, the social determinants of health, in an equitable fashion.
You know, and Jerome, to be clear, I'm going to say something that's going to be sort of clumsy, but when we're having conversations like this across the country, especially when there are white men with microphones, we got to be willing to be clumsy and be willing to learn and listen. I don't want to keep asking, especially black leaders, you know, do you have hope? Is this the moment? Because, you know, that's a pretty, to be fair, that's a pretty sort of a white question, right? Like,
In other words, have some white people on the show. Let's talk to them, because they have the power and authority to make these changes. It's on them. It really is.
Sure.
It really is.
And you know
what it is also? Melanie would tell you, I'm sorry, Evan, but you know what it is for us? It's exhausting. It's actually depleting our life expectancy, because we are re-traumatizing ourselves every time we have to have this conversation, you know, going, come on, again? You know, we have to take time all day to go talk about this again, even though we're not shy about doing it. But trust me, it wears on us.
I'm listening, and I am sensitive to that. And the reason in this context I bring it up is I just read Wesley Lowery's piece in The Atlantic. Wesley Lowery, a longtime writer for The Washington Post, generally on police issues, but also just on issues of race and equality. And he wrote a piece for The Atlantic saying Minneapolis is the breaking point. And he quotes George Floyd's younger brother, Philanese, who said the following, quote, "People finally see it now. White people too. My brother is going to change the world," end quote. The reason I bring this up is not to give sort of false hope or isn't this nice, everyone's coming together, but to say, if we actually see it right now, then what do we do about it? So Jerome, the follow-up I have to you is, you're right. When you look at the coronavirus, the communities impacted in the heaviest, most painful and tragic ways tend to be communities of color, communities where there is lower income, and yet testing is harder to get there. Why? Why, if we have a community of, I think, well-intended people in healthcare, in social outreach, why is that still happening in this kind of a crisis, Jerome?
Evan, that is the nature of systemic racism. So, full disclosure, I sit on the board of Highland Hospital, right? And the very first board meeting we had in the pandemic, I raised the question of why aren't we able to tell, right? The big we, not just Highland Hospital, who got tested, disaggregated by race. And there was a long, around answer. There's a form that the tester has to complete and check off, and of course there's a box there for race and ethnicity. However, what I learned is that it's not, that box is not necessary in order to get paid by the insurance company.
Mm.
What kind of craziness is that? Now, doing it to just to get paid is the worst reason. Doing it so that, you know, if we're trauma-informed and we know where the disparities are, we've got to get accurate data. Everybody wants to be trauma-informed, data-informed. But when it comes to this particular issue, not so much. Even right now, today, Evan, we, the system of healthcare delivery, cannot tell what is the racial breakdown of who got tested in Monroe County. That's an indictment on all of us. And that is, again, as young people say, that's a receipt number 587,000 of why systemic racism is so pervasive, because that's no one person's responsibility. That's the whole system's responsibility. And we have to push on that to make sure that that changes. Anything that happens, the census is, we're in the census right now. Why do we take the census? Why do we take the information? Because it's important for the allocation of resources. So going back to the example of the pandemic, why weren't we collecting that data? It was on nobody's radar screen who ran things. But I'm telling you, if Melanie Funchess was running it, I bet you they would have taken that information. Mm-hmm. So,
but Evan,
yes.
Sorry, I want to interject here. Evan, something that we have to understand. The reason white supremacies exist is dominant culture can live and not have to see us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when you, because this is a perfect example, when you know that health disparities exist, we knew going in what we were, what, how this was going to play out, because we know how, we know the disparities exist for in every single health domain. Yet our health director and not one epidemiologist, not one person in our county thought, oh, we need to collect this this data by race and ethnicity. We need to collect testing data by race and ethnicity to compare it with, to lay it against, you know, all of our other data, because we are not thought of. People want to know, why are people tearing stuff up in the streets? Because when Colin Kaepernick kneeled, no one heard him. When people walk silently, no one heard us.
Say that.
Okay. And when you want, and I want you to ask me, I'm hopeful. Ask me the question. Ask me.
Are you hopeful?
It is my duty to fight for my freedom. It is my duty to win. We must love and care for each other. I have nothing to lose but my chains.
But my chains.
Understand and be clear. Hope is something that I don't have the privilege to lay in. What I have to lay in is work. It is my duty to fight for my freedom. It is my duty to win. And in that fight, we must love and care for each other, and I have nothing to lose but my chains.
We're talking to members of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group who have been working for years now in our community at the kinds of issues that we're discussing this hour, a path to achieving health equity and understanding how racism impacts health and well-being and as a social determinant. So what I want to do is, after our only break, I want to take a couple of your phone calls because some of our listeners want to weigh in. And I will let all of our guests respond to some of your comments or thoughts on these issues as we talk to members of the Black Agenda Group, Melanie Funchess, Jerome Underwood, Jackie Dozier, Michael Campbell. We're going to talk about the path to achieving health equity as laid out by the Health Equity Institute. And it is not a one thing. Unfortunately, there's not just one thing that needs to happen here. There's a lot of intertwined and interconnected ideas, and we're going to make sure we get specific and work through that here. To Jerome's point, A lot of it is on people like me, people who look like me. What's the work now? Just because you see it doesn't mean that you're willing to change it. But they're asking us to really understand the conditions that have led to this moment, the history that's led to this, and the path perhaps out of it. Let's take that break, and your phone calls are next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, would you go out to eat outside? Well, thousands of people across our area are doing that ever since the governor gave the green light for outdoor dining last week. And now, restaurants are likely to get the green light for indoor dining on Friday as well. But is there enough space to eat outdoors? Can people walk down the street and not come into contact with diners? Is enough being done? We discuss it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kevin in Rochester is first on the phone. Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me on. I'll try and be as quick as I can here and make a couple quick points. I've been a lifelong white male and been part of the working class for my whole life, and I can give you some perspective that hopefully might give you a little hope that how I see it and how I've been part of it, and that is ignoring. I know everybody gets upset at the KKK, as they should rightfully, but to me, the worst kind of racism is the one you don't see that's behind closed door and whispers. And my own personal belief is that that's what needs to be rooted out, not only in police departments, but everywhere where the closet, unknowing guys who are just ignorant, who make statements, joking, whatever. None of it's a joke anymore, and it's real. And it needs to be rooted out in every aspect from within by people like myself and alike that just aren't comfortable with anybody even making a slight joke about it, because it just means that it exists. And we need to stop being uncomfortable with the fact and the notion of when you hear it, to say something, even if it makes you uncomfortable. And that's all it is. It's just people not willing to step out when they see it. And us white people see it more than anything and don't do anything about it. The other thing I want to talk to is about Wegmans. So Wegmans, I grew up in the city, and on Driving Park, Wegmans, one of the original ones, they lived in the city. Wegmans grew in the city, and all they've done is step away from the city now and left the city. And with that, they left nothing. Jobs left, good food left. And as an example, I went to Tops on Upper Falls just to grab, pick up something. And just walking through the aisles, everything is different. Your choices are different. They're limited. It's mostly crap. It's terrible. There's a huge discrepancy. You know, you don't see them proposing Whole Foods on Upper Falls Boulevard. It's in Parrington. It's in all these places. Our community, these leaders like Wegmans and all these other places, need to put their best foot forward on these things and try to help revitalize with jobs and good food. The easy part, not just about money and all that stuff. It's terrible what I've seen. There's big discrepancies. It's almost like a city within a city. There's two separate cities that I see. And I personally invested in the north side on my own, sold everything just to help revitalize part of that north side. And I love to take part in that. And I would love to see people with actual money and business sense come in and be part of the solution along with you guys. And hopefully that helps. I'll listen.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you for that. Let me ask all of our guests, and I want to bring Jackie Dozier in first. Jackie, you want to respond to some of what you heard there? Once again, Jackie, let's make sure you're off mute. Do we have you, Jackie?
Hi, I'm here. Sorry.
That's okay. This is the pandemic world of talk shows. It's all right. The listeners are good with that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Can I get the question again?
Yeah, well, he's talking about what he sees as, you know, a differing Rochester, you know, Wegmans leaving Rochester, grocery stores pulling out and leaving fewer options, fewer jobs. And he sees essentially a two community city abandoned in many ways by companies like Wegmans, and that the impact that can have. Do you see it that way?
Of course, yes. As Melanie mentioned earlier, and Jerome, when we talk about having food deserts in our community and no grocery stores that people have access to, and having to leave the city to go perhaps into the suburbs or take a bus to get groceries, and not having a choice of using those food deserts, yes, there is, it's a tale of two cities.
Hmm. Michael Campbell, what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, can you hear me, Evan?
I can, yes.
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank Kevin for calling in. Some of his observations are spot on. It's unfortunate that Wegmans decided to move away from the base that helped it build its strength in the food market area. You know, that's one of the things that that's our responsibility, to educate people in our communities about how to eat healthy and how to get healthy food. I mean, eventually we're going to get down to growing our own food, but, you know, before we can do that, we need to have access to fresh vegetables and fresh fruits. And one of the things that we do through the programming in our organization is to encourage people to go to places like the public market. It's open on Saturdays. It's open on Tuesdays. It's open on Thursdays. And then other places in the community where we can get fresh fruits and vegetables as well. So those are the kind of things that we have to do to combat organizations like Wegmans leaving the inner city community.
Hmm. Let me ask Jerome and Melanie to respond to that as well. Jerome?
I'll echo, you know, what my elder Mike said, you know, and you know, Kevin, I think the caller was spot on, but it's not just Wegmans, you know. So, you know, budgets are statements of value, you know, and if, you know, by somebody, you know, moving whatever it is, whether it's, and it's not only what's moving out, but it's also what's moving in. And, you know, there's no sign anywhere in America that says welcome to the hood. But you sure know when that you're there, you know, with the prevalence again of liquor stores and things that are counter to progressive well protected community. You don't see 5 and 6 liquor stores on one street in Pittsford, Perrington, any one of our suburbs. You know why? Because white people are not going to have that, you know? So it's not just Wegmans. It's systemic. So the thing is, if you, and Melanie mentioned, if you see somebody's humanity, and my humanity is equitable to yours, you behave a certain way. And what we are very, very sober about, you know, you can't make somebody love somebody. You can't, because if you don't recognize my humanity, like from jump, you're really going to act differently, you know. So, but at the same time, we can hold people accountable for their actions or their inactions. And part of what Mike mentioned is educating our community, because despite all of that, people are living and thriving, but having to do all that extra work is what makes it a social determinant of health and reduces people's life expectancy by far unacceptable rates. It's real, you know, and Kevin Carr, you know, so, you know, like I said, you have the four of us on here and we're grateful for that, you know, but we really want to know what white people think about this and what they are specifically going to do. And this is part of our declaration. It's easy to say, yes, we stand with the Black Agenda Group, but we want to know specifically, what are you going to do to change your practice, to change policies, and what kind of advocacy are you going to engage in to make sure, again, that we don't get back here the next time around?
Melanie Funches.
You know, what needs to be said has been said. You know, it's all about what you see and what you don't see. I agree with what all has been said so far. But the thing is, it's not just what you can buy and not buy. It's what you see and don't see. When, like Jerome said, there's not a sign that says, welcome to the hood. But if you go and you ride along the road and you see billboards, you won't ride along the billboards and ride along in Fairport or in Pittsburgh or the other place and see billboards for liquor or for anything not healthy, like you see in the Black community, right? You don't see open advertisement of things that are not good for you. You know, it's the fact is that if we want to invest, like Jerome said, what are you going to do? Let me see how you talk green. It's reparations time. And when we start using language like that, people get frightened. But the thing is, the same way that you divested, you need to reinvest. Because the way that we, the reason we, let me, I don't think we really said this clearly. The reason we want to declare this racism as a public health crisis, because when things are declared a health crisis, it means you change the way that you address it. When they said we're going to find a cure for cancer, right? And we had this whole push toward cancer. All kinds of funds went to eradicating cancer. If we are saying that racism is a public health crisis and it's hurting people, that means funds are going toward eliminating the root causes of racism, root causes that are hurting the social determinants of health. That means improved housing, improved education, improved economic employment, improved air quality in communities, improved access to health care. All of these things, improved access to healthy fruits and vegetables, improved economic opportunities in community. If people want to know what they can do, that is what they can do. I'm thankful to the caller.
There are some themes here that Melanie and the guests just brought up that I think some of our other phone callers want to get to. Let me get Bridget and then Beatrice. Bridget in Honey Oye Falls, go ahead.
Hi. So I study political science, and this is actually a really interesting conversation because one of the themes that we're seeing in political science is how we can be interdisciplinary. So, for example, I know that the U of R is doing stuff with lupus patients, and they're realizing that some lupus patients who are people of color are struggling to get to their appointments, to get medicine, is because of things like access to transportation, access to medication, that kind of stuff there. So my concern is that while we're hearing things like systemic racism, we're kind of ignoring the political science approach to this here and the whole literature that they have on it. So, for example, we're hearing things like how white people need to go ahead and change their attitude, but a political scientist is going to have to point out problems like the free rider problem. And I guess my question is how do medical doctors and things like public health crises have to interact with this political side of issues and how they navigate it from their point of view? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it builds on Melanie's point there. So to Melanie, I'll start with you. You know, when you're talking about when you declare a public health crisis, then it can direct some emergency attention. Sometimes it's funding, et cetera. And Bridget is, I think, right to say you have to have some political will to make certain changes. How do you see the interaction, especially locally, with the political community? Are you seeing a redirecting of funding, a reinvesting where it was divested from, and some other solutions that might be tied to politics, Melanie?
And the thing, we have to remember, okay, and this may be a worldview thing. I live in an African worldview, which is diurnal, which means both and. Okay, so it's not either or. But just because we're saying it's a public health crisis does not mean that we are ignoring the political view. So just like we said, we need all these things. 50A, which is the law that Governor Cuomo got rid of, that makes it so that police records are now open, right? That ties into public health because the mental health effects of Black people and on their feelings around policing, right? It affects their mental health. But that was something that happened in the political sphere. but it affects the health of African Americans. You know, there are all kinds of ways that we can do this. If we talk about change, when we talk about this, we're talking about changing housing policy. That means we're talking to our legislators. Yes, we're talking to our legislators, because the goal of this is going to the county executive and to the governor. Just like they've done in Franklin County, just like they did in Milwaukee County, just like they're doing in communities all around this country. This is where we're going, and we're taking it to the political places. What we need to do is we need to come as a community. You know, we're choosing to do it this way because it says, there's an African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And we're trying to tell our community, let's go together.
I'm sorry, Mel. Mel, if I can, I'm sorry, Evan, if I can, I'd like to just say something to Bridget. Poli-sci. One of the things, and Melanie is so on point in terms of worldview, this encapsulates every aspect of living. And, you know, what I have for Bridget is more of a question in terms of political science. I'm wondering, as she and her colleagues are studying political science, if any of those books that they're reading were written by authors of African descent, so that an African worldview, an African-centered, a pan-African worldview can be presented, because I guarantee you it will be remarkably different from a Eurocentric worldview. You know, and for us as people who are African in origin, our worldview, and Melanie mentioned that, you know, we're diurnal in terms of our logic, but our axiology and our epistemology is also different, and it informs the way that we think, love, make decisions. So if you are a political leader or a political science a teacher or a student, and you are doing something that is going to impact the life of people of African descent and Latino descent, you ought to know something about their axiology, epistemology, and logic, so that you can co-create with them things that are going to reflect their worldview, as opposed to the narrow Eurocentric worldview that is pervasive across this country. So it's every aspect of living that has to change.
And by the way, Bridget, the fault was really with the interviewer. This is a group that has been working on a multi-pronged approach for many years now, and certainly they understand politics has to be part of the solution. The interviewer, that would be me, I've been focused on health, but don't take that to mean that they don't, I think, see that mechanism as important, vital. And Melanie's right. Look at just this week. We are seeing a couple of things happening locally. Mary Lupien from City Council was just tweeting that 2 out of 6 demands from the local Black Lives Matter movement have now been met because of the pressure that is coming on the political system. So certainly that is part of it here. Beatrice has been waiting. Let me take her phone call. Hi, Beatrice. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Evan, thank you for those wonderful, wonderful people you got on today. I love the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing they said. And the man that called in, the white man, that name was Kevin.
Kevin, yes.
What he said was absolutely 100% true. It's not on us to change things. We're not messing things up as far as racism going, hatefulness toward another race and all that, and keeping people, you know, down on the ground. It's the white people. And what he said was so beautifully true, you know, and it made me cry. You know, it's up to the person who's causing the trouble to change. And you cannot legislate change in people's hearts, really. But we have to legislate still and make some things into law. But God's given people a chance to fall on their knees and repent of the egregious sins that they have committed, that they are committed, and that they're thinking about committing. Because once they see Christ Jesus coming on that cloud, it's going to be too late to say, I'm sorry. And so the white people who hate black people and who is going to do everything to keep them down from their own, really, God's sake, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. He loves black people. We're beautiful people. Black is beautiful. The blacker the man's skin is, I've always found I was so attracted to it. But thank you for taking Kevin. Kevin, I love you, honey. If you're listening, I love you, Kevin. You've made my heart cry and rejoice. I just love you because you just said it. It's out on us, Kevin. You know, I love you, baby. God bless you, honey. God bless your guests, too. God bless you, baby. Thank you. Thank you, Evan, for taking my call. Woo.
Anytime you want to call Beatrice, the line's yours.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
God bless you guys.
Thank you. That's powerful stuff from Beatrice. And let me also just say, sort of building on Beatrice's point and putting the emphasis on Kevin's point about the need for white people to actually act and not just wait to be educated or wait to take action or call out for change. One of the things we're going to talk about soon on this program, perhaps this week or next, is the idea that in certain geographical spaces, racism might be sort of more comfortable. White people might feel more comfortable, like, well, I can say these things here because it's safer, or I could do these things. Well, we've seen events in Fairport, now Skinny Atlas, people ripping down Black Lives Matter artwork or flyers and signs, and immediate consequence, immediate backlash, even in the suburbs or more rural areas. And perhaps, again, that is an indication that in this moment, it's not just white people waiting for others to do the work. So to Beatrice and to the point that the caller Kevin made, perhaps that this moment is producing something a little more tangible. We'll explore that on a program soon. Let me ask the guests to kind of share with you where they'd like to direct your attention as we get ready to wrap the hour here. I'll start with Michael Campbell on this. And as I read, Michael, the path to achieving health equity laid out by the Health Equity Institute has 8 different prongs on it, including housing, discrimination and minority stressors, food security and access to healthy food, stable income and job security, environmental quality, neighborhood conditions, quality affordable health care, and educational opportunities. It's not just one thing that has to happen. And this is decades and centuries of an interwoven structure in a system that we've been discussing. Where do you want our audience to focus their attention as we get ready to wrap the hour and think about social determinant of health being racism and what might change that?
Evan, I think, what was the name of the caller before Beatrice? The
Bridget.
Poli-Sci caller?
Bridget, yes.
Bridget. I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to very briefly engage that question of our rights in the voting arena, because eventually police defunding and a lot of these issues are going to come to the polls. And voting rights have been under attack for the last few years in this country. And these laws lead to significant burdens for eligible voters trying to exercise their most basic rights. Since 2008, states across the country have passed measures making it harder for Americans, particularly Black people, the elderly, students, and brown people, people with disabilities, to exercise their fundamental rights to vote. Voter suppression is very prevalent in our country right now, and we need to be able to vote in order to get the things onto the ballot, not only get things onto the ballot, but to get things moving in our communities that are going to make these changes, that keep billboards with negative message and supporting alcohol and violence out of our communities. So that's very, very important. And I would encourage people to visit the ACLU website and look at ways that we can fight voter suppression. And that's my answer.
Okay, Jackie Dozier.
I agree with Michael Campbell. Voting, people need to vote. We need to vote. These are challenging times right now for us with not being able to go into the polls. We need to be unified, and everybody needs to get out and vote.
Jerome Underwood.
Two things to me, Evan, in terms of where people would, should start. I think they should start with their families and their relatives and their friends in terms of challenging them to what they're going to do differently to counteract this or not, knowing that, you know, consequences of that may be you don't get invited back to Thanksgiving, or you get written out the will, or checks may not be written to you, which I think is a very, very small price to pay given what, you know, people of color have been experiencing for now 401 years. That's one. Secondly, the next thing is for you, Evan Dawson, my challenge to you. You have been, you got a nice following, Evan, and I've seen you use your privilege to elevate this issue. And we're asking, because racism is a public health crisis, for you to ratchet that up. We want you to invite white people onto your show to continue to talk about this and see if you can get some specifics out of them in terms of what they're going to do in the corporations that they run in their neighborhoods so that, you know, we can talk to them and really hold them accountable to what actions they commit to, because endorsing the pledge is a transaction. Mm-hmm. We're interested in the transformation of what's going to change.
Yes,
that's
sir.
How
I take the challenge and I take the responsibility, and I'm glad to be pushed. Thank you, Jerome. And Melanie, we're almost out of time, about 40 seconds. Go ahead, Melanie Funches.
I want everyone to maximize every platform that they have to amplify the message that we need to have. If you are in media, amplify them. Use your media to amplify. If you are in schools, teach. If you're a parent, teach your kids to be anti-racist. Whatever your platform is, maximize it, amplify the message so that we can all be free, because it's not just about my humanity, it's about yours.
I want to thank all of our guests for pushing us, for challenging us, and for educating. Melanie Funches, Jerome Underwood, Jackie Dozier, Michael Campbell, members of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group who have been doing this work for years. And you hear the intensity of this work and the urgency. Thanks to all of the feedback and for all four panelists. Thank you for making the time and being on this program, and we will continue with this work and talk to you very soon.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thanks to the entire team here at Connections today. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we will talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.